This is A Question of Balance on 2SER 107.3 FM. Good evening, I'm Ruby Vincent. On A Question of Balance, every year usually we've been able to go up to Broome and to spend some time at their wonderful Broome Bird Observatory. Sadly, this hasn't been possible the last 2 years, but we have managed to get Chris Hassell, who is a researcher and a hugely active person up there, on Skype. Hello there, Chris. It really is wonderful to hear your voice again.
Thank you very much, Ruby. It's nice to hear you too. I hope all is well down there.
Now, I was thinking about the Broome Bird Observatory because we stayed there back in, I think, 2007 or so, and you had already been around for ages. That was 1 year when the Dutch research team was up there, the mud bashers, as you call them. And I can remember the place was thriving, although somewhat primitive. But what struck me then was the fact that it was running largely on solar power. And we're talking a long time ago. And I don't think it had started that year on solar.
No, we started the solar in January 1996. The solar array was put in. We have the same panels still and some additional panels, but it works perfectly in that remote location, absolutely perfectly. We did have a very large expense just in the last month when we had a new inverter, but the previous one had done us for 21 years, so that's not too bad. We've got the storage batteries, so yeah, with a backup generator, of course, but on sunny days, which we get mostly up here, it keeps the place running perfectly adequately. And even with the new inverter, even when people click their air conditioners on in their rooms, that used to often trip the generator to come on, but it doesn't anymore. It works, I wouldn't say seamlessly, but close to.
1996. You must be older than many of the people who come and visit the observatory now.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
I was somewhat taken back when I saw them, because way back then, now that was, as I said, 2006 or 7, they were designed to follow the sun. That must have been a bit of an advance for those days.
Yes, it was very snazzy. They are on a pivot and they have a tank with a liquid in, turns into a gas and flows through a pipe, then gets into another tank opposite side of the array, and then brings the weight, and the solar panel tracks round with the sun. So first thing in the morning when you get up, it's pointing to the east, and as the day comes round, it just pivots round, and in the evening, it's pointing directly to the west. So it gets sun, the constant sun all the time. It's a very clever array and very efficient. And in the good old days, or the bad old days, depending how you look at it, the Bird Observatory used to get 2 or 3 hours of power a day. The generator went on at about 6 as it got dark and stayed on till 8 or 9. So that's when you had to do everything that you needed electricity for. And now, of course, 24 hours a day, air conditioner for the guests, modern office with all the equipment. So, it's been an absolutely wonderful for the Bird Observatory.
And in an era before the great green energy revolution and a remote location. Now, that must have cost a lot of money. How did you get going?
We got outside funding from, I think, Horizon Power. The company that put it in, who I can't remember, I'm afraid, Ruby, they were fantastic. The guy was so helpful. I could ring him up. He would be in Perth. I could ring him up and say, this has happened, and he would go, oh, Chris, push *7, what does it say on the dial? And I'd say X, Y, or Z, and he'd say, okay, do this, do that. And I could mend the system, repair the system while talking to him on the phone in Perth, and he could log in to it as well and see what was going on. There was one wonderful time where the inverter broke down like an hour before one of our five-day courses. So I was in a blind panic, rang him up, and he said, oh, okay, let's have a look. And I went in on the phone and pushed this button and pushed that button. And he went, okay, Chris, I know what it is. You need to drive into town. You need to buy a 50-cent fuse, come back, put it in, and it'll be fine. So I drove into town, brought a 50-cent fuse, came back. And back, I think the whole array had cost us something like $100,000 back then. And I put in this 50-cent fuse and the whole thing came back on and we ran the course quite successfully. But that made me chuckle that a 50-cent fuse was all we needed to get this incredible state-of-the-art solar system going again.
Is that recent or is that way back?
No, so that's in 96. The array we got then was, you know, the modern of the modern sort of thing.
Okay. Did you people pay for that or was that given to you? Or where did you get that funding from? What I'm trying to figure out.
It went in like 2 months before I arrived at the Bird Observatory. And when I arrived there, I was volunteering. I wasn't working. We wouldn't have paid for it. We wouldn't have had the money. We would have put next to nothing into it. So Horizon Power certainly had some input into it. The guy who put it in, but it's 21 years ago and I can't remember accurately enough.
Okay, that's right. What I really want to know was where'd the money come from to get the Broome Bird Observatory going?
To get the Bird Observatory itself going, back in 1998, we're about to have next year is our 30th anniversary of the Bird Observatory. We've been tucked out there on the edge of Roebuck Bay for 30 years and now refer to ourselves as the shorebird capital of Australia, which is no exaggeration. The Bird Observatory started up by some very helpful, the president of the Shire at the time allowed us to get a little block of land that has subsequently turned into parks and wildlife land, and they own the land, but we have the lease at the peppercorn rate for 20 years, I think it is now, latest one. And it was set up by donations. Lord McAlpine of the famous Cable Beach Club gave us some old buildings. Woodside gave us an old donga from a mining site, which is still all those buildings are still there, looking a little bit ragged around the edges, but all still there and comfortable and functional. Woodside have just helped us out again just in the last months and given us another building. This is a much larger, much more modern building, and we're going to have that as an interpretation centre and office. So that'll be a fantastic bonus to us. And we've also just refurbished our shade house. The shade house is where the guests go and they cook. It's like a camp kitchen and it's wonderful. There's bird baths outside with birds coming in and out to the bird baths all day long, wallabies coming in to drink, and we've just refurbished that, and that really now is a very, very comfortable building. It used to be very hot, now it's beautifully comfortable and cool. So yeah, the Bird Observatory is going well. We've got fantastic staff at the minute, very knowledgeable, all of them, high quality staff. So it really is a top-notch place at the moment.
Where do you get the funds from to keep...
Generated all ourselves. We were set up initially with money from what was then RAOU, that was then Birds Australia and now BirdLife Australia. But ever since that inception, we've generated the money ourselves through tours, accommodation, hosting research groups. You mentioned the mud work, the benthos work that is done there. Also the big shorebird expeditions that the Australasian Wader Study Group run once a year. So basically, that's how we fund ourselves. We get a few grants here and there, but mostly generated through tours, accommodation and hosting research.
In the House, Cult Film Classics return to events in Ms. George Street, October 27, with the spookiest of horror classics, Poltergeist and Army of Darkness, to celebrate Halloween. They know what scares you.
They're here.
This is my boomstick.
Hosted by Seven's Jabba and Quinny from Supernova, check the full In the House program and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER.
Well, when I've been there, there have been various student groups from America, actually, and various other places, who were off as part of their university courses overseas, doing a stint on shorebirds. So they're not just dedicated twitchers that you have there. They're heaps of ordinary people.
Not at all. We very much get the people who come to camp there. Plenty of them are birders, but not all of them by any means. It's a beautiful campsite. It's quiet. You know, we mentioned the solar panels, so there's no generators rattling along in the background. It's right on the edge of Roebuck Bay, next to even the woodland. The woodland itself round here isn't very spectacular, but it's full of life, full of birds. So, yes, we get plenty of people who just like the more remote, quiet camping areas, as well as the casual birder. But we do, of course, get our hardcore bird watchers. It is one of the best places in Australia to come and see. Well, it's the best place to come and see shorebirds, and one of the best places to see birds in general. So we do get a whole array of people visit.
And I love the fact that the red, rough road to it is largely not passable for part of the year by ordinary cars. You really do need to be dedicated and have the right vehicle to be able to get there. And that's rather good for the wildlife, like the wallabies that are there.
Yeah, once we have big rains, which we had this year, the road can be quite challenging, but that really is only for, should only be for 2 or 3 months of the year. The most of the year you can get in a two-wheel drive, but you shake around a little bit on the corrugations, but nothing that anybody would, care about. But it's a beautiful spot. You go down that deep red road with the green trees and the beautiful blue bay on your right, and then just pop into the bird observatory. It is a very nice spot. I've been very attached to it for 21 years.
It's not just the bay around it that I love. It's round the back. Is it a kind of a swamp, or there's mangroves way up the end, but in the foreground there's kind of just short growth there, a great big bull wandering around in it too.
Yeah, we've got a variety of habitats, which is one of the reasons it's so good for birds. We've got the bay and the mudflats, so you get the terns and you get the shorebirds and the egrets and the herons on there. Then there's the along the east coast of the bay, there's thick mangroves, and around Broom Town there's thick mangroves, so you get all the mangrove specialist birds in there. Behind the mangroves, moving inland, there's salt marsh, which can be quite barren at times, but once it floods on a big tide, becomes very suitable to birds. And then from the salt marsh, again moving inland, you move onto some beautiful grassy plains. That's a cattle station. The stocking isn't intense, and there's fantastic birds out there. And also in very, very heavy rain events, that grassland floods and becomes a breeding habitat for thousands, or quite literally tens of thousands of birds. That is obviously really, really big rain events, but we had that this year. We had over 1,000 millimetres this year, over a metre of rain this year, and there was literally tens of thousands of birds breeding on the flooded grassland just inland from the bay, including rare and elusive species like Australian painted snipe, with a number of nests found. So, yeah, it's a seriously exciting spot. You can come there to sit back and enjoy the peace and quiet, or you can come there and get out and about and see some sensational birds.
And we didn't even mention the fantastic, huge tides that you have twice a day, every second week. It's just incredible to be there and be there 1 hour, and then 4 hours later you sort of think, my God, where's that beach? And it's 6 feet underneath the water.
Yeah, that's I can explain the mangroves to people, and I can explain the woodland, but you've got to see the tide, haven't you, Ruby? You really have. It is incredible. 30 feet of tidal range. Yeah, you can look out over the bay and see literally kilometres of mud, and drive back there, go away, have a cup of tea, drive back 3 hours later, and you can only just see the tops of the mangroves. just see the tops of the mangroves with the blue water splashing over them. Yeah, it's some of the biggest tides in the world. Just to the north of us, Derby has even bigger tides, and there's the Bay of Fundy in Canada, the River Severn in the UK. But really, we're right up there in the biggest tides of the world.
I'm Petra de Groei in Robe Bay. First time was in 1991, and it's exactly the same, still the same quality, beauty. It's the most beautiful place in the world. It's so pristine and so remote and so wild. Here, really, nature rules. The tide is magnificent, and there's hundreds and thousands of birds using the bay to feed and to roost. There is no other place in the world like this, and it's the colors, the atmosphere. For me, I think this is what nature should be like. The first time I came back with Teunis Piersma. We have done a lot of scientific work now since 1991. And it's done in cooperation with Conservation and Land Management in Perth. And the person behind it is Grant Pearson. So we all go out on the mud, all sorts of people from all sorts of countries, and a little group of scientists, and we join each other, and we, for 10 days, we dig in the mud, take out all the creatures that live there, which might be the food of the birds that feed here. My background is that I'm a specialist in feeding ecology of birds, so I always look at the creatures in the mud from the bird's eye view. And if you walk somewhere, you think, what will be in the mud, what a bird can eat. Well, that makes it special for me, because I'm not really a marine biologist who's interested in all the creatures that live in the mud. I always want to know what is in the mud, what the birds can eat, and what can bring them all the way up to Asia later in the year.
You know, Chris, something that when people say mud, doesn't give the right... it's a wrong impression. That's not mud that's exposed. It's like palest silk. That's what it's like. It's not dark brown. It's kind of oyster-coloured, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a nice description. Yeah, it's got a real sheen to it. It's incredibly fine. Most of it, there's obviously different structures. Some of it's a bit sandy, some of it's fairly coarse, but the majority of it is this very, very fine silt and packed with life. I mean, absolutely brimming with life, with benthos, which means of the mud. So anything living in the mud or on the surface of the mud, we just give the general term benthos to. And Roebuck Bay is actually, this is a lovely quote, the most biodiverse bay in the world that has so far been studied. We may, as we move on, study places that have the same or even higher biodiversity than Roebuck Bay, but currently it's the most biodiverse bay in the world for its benthic animals.
Yes, which is why the Dutch researchers keep on coming back.
It is indeed. It's famous for its birds, it's famous for its benthos.
One such person is Professor Teunis Piersma from the Netherlands. How big would the area be of Roebuck Bay?
Well, it's a couple of square hundred kilometres of intertidal flat, and we are only mapping 10% in the far north, so the bay is much, much larger. Especially in the Crab Creek corner, so that's the corner of the bay, especially at spring tides, you get this enormous view of very, very, almost like endless mud flats stretching out in front of you, and they are even more endless if you would try and access those, because it's all very, very deep mud. We do access them by hovercraft. It's basically the only way to get across, but you have this incredible sense, this just goes on and on and on and on, this enormous mud flat. This area is far bigger than Sydney Harbour. Biodiversity is important for many, many different reasons, and actually it's the most biodiverse mudflat we know of anywhere in the world. So that's one of the important things. And the other important thing is that all that biodiversity is food for the shorebirds that come here, and they come from great distances to make a living here, either for the non-breeding season, so that's for the southern summer and the northern winter, or pass through here to areas much further south, up to New Zealand. And of course, these birds, they connect countries, and these countries have agreed that they treasure that resource and that they'll protect these resources by protecting the areas they live in. So I guess that's another importance. For me, the most important thing of the bay is the inspirational value, both with regard to this unknown biodiversity. We know so incredibly little of. I mean, there's a whole world in itself. We were talking about mudskippers just a minute ago. And mudskippers, what do we know about mudskippers? What do we know about mudskipper society? What can we learn from mudskipper societies? All these millions of mudskippers living here in this deep mud. We don't know anything. We hardly know the species. And then, of course, it's also the inspiration of these small birds that connecting countries very far apart. That's another inspirational thing. And how they make a living here. And actually, these shorebirds don't live in a world of richness. No wild animal lives in a world of richness. It's rather living on the margin. They can just barely sustain here, and especially when they have to fly north again. They really have to be very, very capable foragers to get enough extra food in order to deposit the fat stores in order to fly north. So one of the intriguing things we found out here is that a lot of the birds here take 3 or 4 years to actually learn the ropes of being a shorebird and being capable enough of flying up north again.
What do you mean by that, Tennis?
Well, they have to stay here for a couple of breeding seasons because they are simply not capable of putting on the fat stores to fly back and reproduce themselves. This is the work of Danny Rogers. He's been looking at the foraging of different age classes. He has really a lot of evidence now that these birds actually have to learn to be good foragers in such a complicated biodiverse area. So they have to learn where they have to go. They have to learn exactly how to find the different prey species. They have to learn how to cope with the different prey species. And of course, they have to update themselves on all the changes that are taking place all the time. So that's quite remarkable, I think.
Tennis, you've said that this is a very rich area for benthos. Why is it so rich?
For two reasons it's very rich. First of all, we find ourselves in the richest biogeographical province in the world. This means that overall marine biodiversity is very high in the Indo-Pacific to start with. And that probably means that in the fullness of time, and we're talking epochs now, there have been very few radical changes in the environment, which means that there has been a lot of time for speciation. So a lot of species have evolved.
That's Professor Tornes Piersma from the Netherlands.
Now, the coast, not so much the bay, but the coast is now famous for its dinosaur footprints. We've got those dinosaur trackways up the Indian Ocean coast. So Broome's a very special place.
Indeed. And the rate at which it tends to erode, because those Pindon cliffs do tend to wear away quite easily, and it keeps revealing more dinosaur footprints, which must be making some archaeologists slather at the teeth with joy.
Well, it's already one of the places in the world now for dinosaur prints. There's big trackways all the way up the Indian Ocean at Broome and north of Broome.
Everything you say really does support the notion. This place is still pretty undisturbed. It is a wondrous wilderness. Please, can we save this and keep it as a true record and study place of one of the oldest parts of land that we can get to on the entire Earth.
Yeah, it's an intriguing mix, because in the modern world it is relatively accessible. You can fly here, you can hire a car, you can drive around. In the great scheme of things, it's a remote area, but definitely the whole balance of bringing people in to be able to let them see this wonderful place, but meanwhile not disturbing it too much or encroaching on it. That's the balancing act that surely we're going to get better at. But let's see, there's certainly plenty of local people who have cultural and ecological heritage of our area at the forefront of their minds. So let's hope we can preserve it.
That is an attitude that's very much expanded, isn't it? I think perhaps in response to all the problem with the offshore gas drilling collection and so on.
We don't get any particularly bad impact from oil and gas here. We have some helicopter movements from the airport, but recently a number of groups have been meeting with the helicopter operators and the oil and gas, and they are extremely open. They've even recently been changing some of their flight paths to stay away from sensitive areas. While you can despair now and again, everybody is getting better at liaising and doing the right thing. So I get a sense that we'll manage it here in Broome, perhaps because we'll stay, you know, the town's, I don't know what it is, 20,000 people or something. You know, we're never going to be a 50,000 people town. So I have a positive outlook for Broome and its surrounds in the coming years.
It's not just the birds, Chris, is it? It's the birds are there because the habitat's there. And, it's such a wonderful habitat. It's got all sorts of other creatures there. And the one that it doesn't have too many of, thankfully, is people. I think we've got a chance there.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, look, thank you so much, Chris. I feel heartened to hear that it's doing well up there and that it is surviving in this world that tends to be usually so much to do with, if there's a buck in it, let's make it. It seems to be doing well.
Excellent. I concur.
Chris Housel, who amongst other research roles is also a committee member of the Broome Bird Observatory.
Newtown Record Fair, your monthly vinyl record fair in the heart of Newtown, is back. Dig over 5,000 vinyl records from psych rock to electronica. Listen to live DJs, taste the tasty Cucina menu, sample craft beers on tap, all in a chilled out, family-friendly atmosphere. 2SER presents Newtown Record Fair, Saturday, November 4, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Bank Hotel, King Street, Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, a vinyl record-obsessed sponsor of 2SER.
On the program today, you heard from Chris Housel and also Professor Turnus Piersma and his colleague Dr. Petra Degree, frequent researchers associated with Roebuck Bay. Stories in Soundpass are on the ACOR website, www.aqob.com.au. Please tune in again next week at the same time, and in the meanwhile, please take care of the environment. Bye-bye.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
2SER 107.3.
Some might say the sun.